From New York, this is Democracy Now!
And in Odessa, I met the mother of a 15-year-old girl who was shot by an AR-15. And that mother watched her bleed to death over the course of an hour because so many other people were shot by that AR-15 in Odessa and Midland. There weren't enough ambulances to get to them in time. Hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15, your AK-47.
The 10 leading Democratic presidential candidates appeared for the first time on the same stage Thursday night, sparring over immigration, foreign policy, health care, and President Obama's legacy.
Let me tell you what I think. I think we should have a debate on health care. I think I know that the senator says she's for Bernie. Well, I'm for Barack. I think the Obamacare worked.
Insurance companies last year sucked $23 billion in profits out of the system. How did they make that money? Every one of those $23 billion was made by an insurance company saying no to your health care coverage.
Mayor Buttigieg.
We'll air highlights from the Houston debate and host a roundtable discussion. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Texas, the 10 leading Democratic presidential candidates appeared on the same stage together for the first time Thursday night at a debate at Texas Southern University in Houston. It was the third debate of the primary season, but marked the first time former Vice President Joe Biden and Senator Elizabeth Warren shared the stage. Biden repeatedly defended the policies of former President Obama as he clashed with his rivals over immigration and health care. Biden and other candidates targeted Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders over his Medicare for All bill, along with Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, who supports it. Sanders said the current health care system is a disaster.
We need a health care system that guarantees health care to all people, as every other major country does, not a system which provides $100 billion a year in profit for the drug companies and the insurance companies. And to tell you how absurd the system is, tonight on ABC, the healthcare industry will be advertising, telling you how bad Medicare for All is because they want to protect their profits. That is absurd.
After headlines, we'll spend the rest of the hour airing highlights of Thursday night's debate, and we'll host a roundtable discussion. Hours before Thursday's debate got underway, nearly a dozen Greenpeace activists rappelled off the Fred Hartman Bridge above the Houston Ship Channel in a nonviolent civil disobedience action that brought shipping traffic to a halt in the largest oil export channel in the United States. The protesters were calling for presidential candidates to support the Green New Deal and for a just transition away from fossil fuels. One of the activists, Piper, streamed the action live on social media.
All of the major oil companies depend on this terminal. That includes Exxon, BP, Shell, Chevron. They all depend on this terminal, and right now we are shutting it down.
By late Thursday, police had arrested at least 15 of the activists. The Harris County Sheriff's Office says they'll face a number of charges related to obstructing roadways and waterways. The United Nations is warning 2.2 million people are expected to go hungry in Somalia and are at risk of starvation amidst a massive drought that's withered crops, bringing harvests in the East African nation to 70% below average in some areas. The UN reports unreliable weather patterns and climatic shocks have coupled with widespread poverty to trap millions of Somalis in severe hunger and malnutrition. This comes as a new report finds extreme weather events around the globe displaced a record 7 million people during the first 6 months of the year. The Internal Displacement Monitoring Center warns in its mid-year report, quote, "In today's changing climate, mass displacement triggered by extreme weather events is becoming the norm." The U.S. House of Representatives voted Thursday to block the Trump administration from opening up Alaska's ANWR, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, to oil and gas exploration. The bill had the support of Native Alaskans who depend on migrating caribou herds for their subsistence. Members of the Gwich'in Steering Committee traveled to Washington, D.C. this week to lobby for the drilling ban. They said in a statement, the Gwich'in and caribou have had a spiritual and cultural connection since time immemorial. The future of caribou and the future of the Gwich'in are the same. claim harm to the caribou is harm to the Gwich'in way of life, unquote. A companion bill to ban drilling in Anwar is not expected to pass the Republican-controlled Senate. This comes as Trump administration has announced its final plan to offer oil and gas lease sales across more than 1.5 million acres of Anwar's coastal plains. The plan calls for the creation of landing strips, drill pads, pipeline supports, a seawater treatment plant, 175 miles of roads, and other infrastructure in pristine wilderness along Alaska's north coast. Here in New York, public school administrators say they will not mark students as absent if they have a parent or guardian's permission to join the global climate strike on Friday, September 20th. The youth-led protests will come just days before world leaders gather for a global climate summit at the United Nations headquarters the following Monday. The strike was inspired by Greta Thunberg, the 16-year-old climate activist who last year began skipping classes each Friday to protest outside the Swedish parliament demanding action on catastrophic climate change. Thunberg spoke on Democracy Now! Earlier this week after she sailed across the Atlantic in a zero-emissions racing boat to attend UN climate talks and to join protests in the U.S.
On Friday, I am going to—this Friday, the 13th, I am going to join the school strike for the climate outside the White House in Washington, D.C.
This week, the head of Amnesty International, Kumi Naidoo, sent a letter to 30,000 schools around the world asking them to allow students to join the climate strikes worldwide. The Trump administration says it's finalized the repeal of an Obama-era clean water policy that protects thousands of streams that flow into large rivers and lakes, as well as wetland areas that filter pollutants and absorb floodwaters. Environmental Protection Sea Agency Administrator Andrew Wheeler, a former coal lobbyist, announced the rule change Thursday to thunderous applause during an event at the headquarters of the National Association of Manufacturers in Washington, D.C. Environmentalists say Trump's move to rescind the 2015 regulation known as Waters of the United States rule will remove pollution controls for 60% of U.S. bodies of water, endangering the drinking water of over 100 million people. The Trump administration allow a Michigan man to import the remains of a critically endangered black rhinoceros he shot and killed on a trophy hunt in Namibia last year. A photo of circulated widely on social media shows the hunter, Chris Payerk, and his family smiling as they pose over the corpse of the rhino. Conservation groups say only 5,500 of the animals remain in the wild. President Trump has repeatedly sought to ease U.S. restrictions on the importation of animal remains. Trump's two adult sons, Don Jr. and Eric, are longtime trophy hunters who've repeatedly posed for photos with dead animals they shot and killed in Africa. On Capitol Hill, Democratic Congress members voted Thursday to formally move forward with impeachment proceedings against President Donald Trump. Committee Chair Gerald Nadler said future inquiries would look beyond the findings of the Mueller report.
We have a responsibility to consider allegations of federal election crimes, self-dealing, violations of the Constitution's Emoluments Clause, and the failure to defend our nation from current and future attacks by foreign adversaries.
Democrats remain divided over whether to even call the Judiciary Committee's expanded powers of investigation impeachment inquiry. On Thursday, Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi abruptly ended her weekly press conference after a reporter asked whether the House is conducting a formal inquiry, refusing to answer the question. Mexico's foreign minister, Marcelo Ebrard, said Thursday his nation will not change its immigration policies after the U.S. Supreme Court allowed the Trump administration's ban on most migrants seeking asylum at the U.S.-Mexico border to take effect.
The Mexican government's position has been that we are not going to accept that. And we consulted with the Mexican Senate, and they will not accept it either.
This comes as tens of thousands of asylum seekers are stuck in border cities on the Mexican side, waiting to be processed for initial asylum proceedings in the United States. In the Tijuana-San Diego border alone, there are more than 10,000 migrants in the waiting list to turn themselves in to U.S. immigration officials. The Binational Legal Aid Group, El Otro Lado, tweeted, quote, "We're the only on-the-ground organization here providing legal aid. This is a death sentence for most of our clients. Our hearts are broken and we are exhausted," they said. In Washington, D.C., protesters rallied outside the headquarters of ICE, that's Immigration and Customs Enforcement, Thursday, denouncing the Trump administration's anti-immigrant and anti-refugee policies. This is Jasmine Nazareth of the Fair Immigration Reform Movement.
This agency has done nothing but tear immigrant families apart, and the only way that we're, as a community, as an immigrant community, as Latinos, as people of color, that we're actually going to be truly free and united in this country that we call home is if Congress stops funding agencies like this whose only mission is to tear our families apart.
Protesters later marched to the Washington, D.C. home of Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos to protest the mega online retailer's decision to continue providing ICE with technology, including a database that helps track and apprehend immigrants. In Russia, police raided the homes and offices of activists at 200 sites across more than 40 cities and towns Thursday in the most massive sweep yet against political groups aligned with the opposition leader Alexei Navalny. The government of President Vladimir Putin says the raids were part of a criminal money laundering investigation into Navalny's anti-corruption foundation, also raided where the offices of Golos, an independent election monitoring group. Opposition groups call the charges trumped up and say it's an escalation of a crackdown on Kremlin opponents that included the mass arrest of more than 2,000 people during recent protests in Moscow. In Iran, a woman who set herself on fire to protest her arrest for trying to attend a soccer match has died of her injuries. Sahar Khodayari was jailed for 3 days in March after she disguised herself as a man and tried to enter a Tehran soccer stadium. When Khodayari discovered she'd faced up to 2 years in prison, she self-immolated outside a courthouse in Tehran. Her protest left her with burns on 90% of her body before she succumbed to her injuries on September 8th. Iran has no written laws barring women from soccer stadiums, but Human Rights Watch says a de facto ban is ruthlessly enforced by authorities. Sahar Khodayari's death drew widespread outrage by Iranian social media users who gave her the nickname Blue Girl after her favorite team's colors. Her death also drew protests against the International Soccer Federation, FIFA, which is accused of failing to hold Iran accountable for its discrimination against female fans and athletes. Human rights groups are calling on the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to rescind its award to India's Hindu nationalist President Narendra Modi. Modi is set to receive the Gates Foundation's Global Goalkeeper Prize in New York City September 24th for his public sanitation and hygiene program, which has brought toilet access to millions across India. Yale University epidemiologist Greg Gonsalves called the award outrageous, tweeting, "Bill Gates should be ashamed of himself. Narendra Modi is not worthy of any award. He's a despot in the making, a human rights abuser. Everyone in public health should speak up," he said. Modi was once banned from the United States on charges he did not intervene in a massacre against Muslims in 2002 when he was governor of the Indian state of Gujarat. In August, Modi revoked limited autonomy for Indian-administered Kashmir, arresting thousands of people, setting up roadblocks, imposing curfews, and cutting off the internet and other communications. Back in the United States, California lawmakers voted Wednesday to ban private prisons statewide in a major blow to the for-profit prison industry in the U.S. The legislation also orders the closure of four ICE prisons that can jail up to 4,500 immigrants. The bill now heads to Governor Gavin Newsom for his signature. Newsom said in his January inaugural address that California should, quote, end the outrage of private prisons once and for all. Meanwhile, California lawmakers have approved a bill cracking down on gig economy companies that classify employees as independent contractors rather than hourly workers. Under the legislation, workers who are part of a company's main business or who are directed by a company's managers must be classified as employees instead of contractors beginning January 1st. Governor Gavin Newsom has promised to sign the bill, which could see thousands of workers win a guaranteed minimum wage and workers' compensation insurance. Executives at the ride-hailing apps Uber and Lyft said this week they have no plans to reclassify their drivers as employees. And President Trump has met with widespread protests Thursday as he traveled to Baltimore for a House Republican retreat. It was Trump's first visit to Baltimore since he insulted the city in a July tweet storm as a, quote, disgusting rat and rodent-infested mess, adding no human being would want to live there. It was part of an attack on House Oversight Chair Elijah Cummings, one of the most prominent African Americans in Congress. Thursday's protests against Trump featured a giant inflatable effigy depicting the president as a rodent clutching a cell phone. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Juan Gonzalez. Welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and across and around the world. The 10 leading Democratic presidential candidates appeared for the first time on the same stage Thursday night at a debate at Texas Southern University in Houston. It was the third debate of the primary season, but marked the first time that former Vice President Joe Biden and Senator Elizabeth Warren took part in the same debate. Biden repeatedly defended the policies of former President Obama as he clashed with his rivals. In one of the most contentious moments of the debate, Obama's former housing secretary, Julian Castro, questioned Biden's memory during an exchange about their health care plans.
The option I'm proposing is a Medicare for all, in a Medicare for choice. If you want Medicare, if you lose the job from your insurance company, from your employer, you automatically can buy into this. You don't have no pre-existing condition can stop you from buying in. You get covered, period.
I want every single American family to have a strong Medicare plan available. If they choose to hold on to strong, solid private health insurance, I believe they should be able to do that. But the difference between what I support and what you support, Vice President Biden, is that you require them to opt in. And I would not require them to opt in. They would automatically be enrolled. They wouldn't have to buy in. That's a big difference because Barack Obama's vision was not to leave 10 million people uncovered. He wanted every single person in this country covered. My plan would do that. Your plan would not.
They do not have to buy in. They do not have to buy in.
You just said that. You just said that 2 minutes ago. You just said 2 minutes ago that they would have to buy in. You said they would have to buy in.
To buy in, if she qualifies for Medicaid,
are you forgetting what you said 2 minutes ago?
Be in for it.
Are you forgetting already what you said just 2 minutes ago? I mean, I can't believe that you said 2 minutes ago that they had to buy in, and now you're saying they don't have to buy. You're forgetting that.
After the debate, the Washington Post questioned the accuracy of Castro's comments. The Post reports he was incorrect that Biden forgot something about his own plan. It was Castro who forgot what Biden said. Former Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke received some of the loudest applause of the night when he discussed enacting new gun control measures after the two recent mass shootings in Texas.
And in Odessa, I met the mother of a 15-year-old girl who was shot by an AR-15. Mm-hmm. And that mother watched her bleed to death over the course of an hour because so many other people were shot by that AR-15 in Odessa and Midland. There weren't enough ambulances to get to them in time. Hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15, your AK-47.
On the foreign policy front, Senator Bernie Sanders chided Joe Biden for voting to support the war in Iraq.
With regard to Iraq, the fact of the matter is that, I should have never voted to give Bush the authority to go in and do what he said he was going to do. The AUMF was designed, he said, to go in and get the Security Council to vote 15-0 to allow inspectors to go in to determine whether or not anything was being done with chemical weapons or nuclear weapons. And when that happened, he went ahead and went anyway without any of that proof. I said something that was not meant the way I said it.
Let me just comment on something that the vice president said. You talked about the big mistake in Iraq and the surge. The truth is, the big mistake, the huge mistake, and one of the big differences between you and me, I never believed what Cheney and Bush said about Iraq. You voted against the war in Iraq and helped lead the opposition. And it's sad to say, I mean, I kind of, had the feeling that there would be massive destabilization in that area if we went into that war.
Meanwhile, Senator Biden criticized Sanders' plan for Medicare for all.
And if you notice, nobody's yet said how much it's going to cost the taxpayer. I hear this large savings. The president thinks, my friend from Vermont thinks that the employer is going to give you back if you negotiate his union all these years, got a cut in wages because you got insurance. They're going to give back that money to the employee?
Matter of fact, they will.
Well, let me tell you something. For a socialist, you got a lot more confidence in corporate America than I do.
Senator Sanders.
George.
Go ahead.
All right. 2 points.
Yep.
You got to defend the fact that today, not only do we have 87 million people uninsured and underinsured, you got to defend the fact that 500,000 Americans are going bankrupt. You know why they're going bankrupt?
because they suffered a terrible disease, cancer or heart disease. Under my legislation, people will not go into financial ruin because they suffered with a diagnosis of cancer. And our program is the only one that does that.
And in one of the more unusual debate moments, the tech entrepreneur Andrew Yang unveiled a plan that may violate campaign finance laws.
It's time to trust ourselves more than our politicians. That's why I'm going to do something unprecedented tonight. My campaign will now give a freedom dividend of $1,000 a month for an entire year to 10 American families, someone watching this at home right now. If you believe that you can solve your own problems better than any politician, go to yang2020.com and tell us how $1,000 a month will help you do just that.
When we come back, we'll hear clips from the ABC Univision debate and host a roundtable discussion. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute. Tomorrow is The Question by Ornette Coleman. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
As we continue to look at the third Democratic debate, we're joined by three guests. Joining us in Houston, where the debate was held, Cesar Espinosa, executive director of FIEL, a Houston-based nonprofit that helps undocumented members of the city's Latino community. He attended last night's debate. In Philadelphia, Julian Brave, NoiseCat, a journalist who belongs to the SEC Pemec and Stotemic Nations. He's the director of the Green New Deal strategy at the think tank Data for Progress. And in Washington is Rashad Robinson, president of Color of Change. I wanted to begin with Cesar. Your reaction, you were there at the debate. Talk to us about your immediate sense of how the debate went.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. I think there could have been a lot more substance in terms of our issue was the issue of immigration. Many topics that were talked about very broadly. But when it came to actually putting immigrants into the conversation, it was a lot of the candidates failed to do so. I mean, and this covers the gamut of education, health care. And obviously, immigration reform. The other thing that really we were disheartened by was the fact that a single candidate did not really have the answers to a very necessary problem that we have now, which is the issue of immigration reform. Many of them talked about broad strokes about a potential plan, but in concrete, a detailed plan of how we're going to bring 11.5 million people out of the shadows, how we're going to bring 1 million Dreamers and TPS recipients out of the shadows was not really talked about in substance. We do applaud the fact that Julian Castro talked about a TPS for Venezuelans, but we would also have liked to see talks about a TPS for the Bahamian people who are right now suffering one of the biggest crises, if not the biggest crisis the country has faced.
We want to also turn to Rashad Robinson in Washington, D.C. You're there for the Congressional Black Caucus major gathering this weekend, but you watched the debate last night. Talk about what you felt was most significant.
I think what's most significant and what continued to be most significant, that yes, these debates give us an opportunity to see where the candidates stand, where the country stands, and have the candidates talk about these issues in broad ways and maybe sometimes in detailed ways. But there's a real gap between the what and the how. this is not simply about the sort of fine details of the individual candidates' campaigns, because in fact, you know, if you go to the polls and vote for Biden, you're not going to necessarily get Biden's health care plan. If you go to the polls and vote for Bernie, you're not going to necessarily get Bernie's health care plan. The gap between what's in their proposal and the actual how it's going to get done and how they're actually going to move it is actually where movements come into play. And we're not looking for a candidate that's going to be the leader of our movements. We need candidates that understand how to work with our movements, how to engage our movements. In fact, one of the big challenges in 08 is that Obama came into office and really tried to build his own movement, tried to be the leader of the movement. I do think for all of these candidates, the ability to actually get these policies done inside of a system that is deeply entrenched with corporations and all sort of incentive structures that will stand in the way of the type of progress that pushes back against the profiteers and all of those that are standing in the way of progress really requires us to have the type of people power to get it done. And that actually is how we have an honest conversation. And unfortunately, the back and forth sometimes about individual details is for naught if we don't actually have the real conversation about power and how we leverage power and leverage everyday people to actually get these things done.
And Julian Brave Noisecat, your overall response to the debate, what was and wasn't included?
You know, I think that the prior two guests raised some really important questions, you know, the issue area questions, especially about immigration in a place like Houston in the context of the climate crisis, incredibly important. How the candidates plan to actually enact their policies, also very important. I was struck personally by the talent on stage last night. You know, I'm a millennial. I scroll Twitter. And I saw that folks were comparing Team Blue to the Avengers. And I guess the question is, if we're going to run with that analogy, you know, which episode of the Avengers is it? Is it, you know, Endgame or Infinity War? Are we going to beat Thanos this time or are we not? And within the party, you know, is there enough young talent to take on someone like Joe Biden and maybe even win the nomination? And, you know, I was very impressed by the talking points put forward by a number of rising voices in the party. But, you know, I think whether one of those folks can rise to the top and become the nominee is still a very open question.
I wanted to ask Rashad Robinson on the issue of race, which was discussed quite extensively at the debate, especially the moment that Beto O'Rourke really had one of the highlight moments of the debate. I wanted to go to when the moderator, Lindsay Davis, asks Beto O'Rourke a question about race.
Vice President. Look, a few weeks ago, a shooter drove 10 miles inspired by this, 10 hours inspired by this president to kill people who look like me and people who look like my family. White supremacy is a growing threat to this country, and we have to root it out. I'm proud that I put forward a plan to disarm hate. I'm also proud that I was the first to put forward a police reform plan, because we're not going to have any more Laquan McDonald's or Eric Garner's or Michael Brown's or Pamela Turner's or Walter Scott's or Sandra Bland here from the Houston area.
That was a glitch there. That was Julian Castro speaking, not Beto O'Rourke. I think we've got Beto O'Rourke now.
Racism in America is endemic. It is foundational. We can mark the creation of this country not at the 4th of July, 1776, but August 20th, 1619, when the first kidnapped African was brought to this country against his will and in bondage and as a slave, built the greatness and the success and the wealth that neither he nor his descendants would ever be able to fully participate in and enjoy. We have to be able to answer this challenge, and it is found in our education system, where in Texas, a five-year-old child in kindergarten is five times as likely to be disciplined or suspended or expelled based on the color of their skin. In our healthcare system, where there's a maternal mortality crisis three times as deadly for women of color, or the fact that there's 10 times the wealth in white America than there is in black America. I'm going to follow Sheila Jackson Lee's lead and sign into law a reparations bill that will allow us to address this at its foundations. But we will also call out the fact that we have a white supremacist in the White House, and he poses a mortal threat to people of color all across this country.
That was Beto O'Rourke last night. Rashad Robinson, your reaction and the fact that we have several presidential candidates who are talking about reparations, first time really in memory, in a presidential race.
I mean, it really is incredible, and it is actually a result of movements, a result of, you know, the narrative change that's been built. Narrative change is about the rules and norms of society, what people see as acceptable and what people can envision as possible. And on the main stage inside of a presidential debate, you have candidates talking about very clear policies that are going to impact the black community, but actually talking about the historical context of how we got here, talking about reparations, talking about slavery in very clear ways, using the term white supremacist on the national stage and talking about white supremacy and white nationalism. I mean, this is a fundamental change from the sort of rules, the unwritten rules of these debates that used to exist, that you had to talk around race, so you couldn't talk directly about race and be considered a kind of legitimate top-tier candidate. That is a result of how we've moved this country. It's also the result of, I think, a lot of people waking up to the failures of the left at avoiding these conversations about race. Unfortunately, our opponents talk about race all the time, not in ways that we want them to, but they are talking about race all the time. And so leaving this conversation to our opponents, pretending like we can talk about solving the ills that are deeply about structural racism without talking about race, is something that I'm so glad that so many candidates are speaking up a bit.
Let's go
about.
Back
and
to New
Beto,
Jersey.
And that Beto O'Rourke moment was just, I think, his finest moment of the night.
And let's go to New Jersey Senator Cory Booker.
And it's nice to go all the way back to slavery, but dear God, we have a criminal justice system that is so racially biased. We have more African Americans under criminal supervision today than all the slaves in 1850. We have to come at this issue attacking systemic racism, having the courage to call it out, and having a plan to do something about it. If I am president of the United States, we will create an office in the White House to deal with the problem of white supremacy and hate crimes. And we will make sure that systemic racism is dealt with in substantive plans, from criminal justice reform to the disparities in healthcare to even one that we don't talk about enough, which is the racism that we see in environmental injustice in communities of color all around this country.
That's New Jersey Senator Cory Booker. Julian Brave Noisecat, if you can respond to what he said.
I thought that Senator Booker bringing environmental injustice and racism into the conversation was a major moment for the environmental movement, broadly speaking, in this country. It really stuck out to me. You know, there has been a long history of people of color fighting the disproportionate siting of waste sites, pipelines, and hazardous materials in our communities. It's ongoing. It's deeply rooted in Houston. And the fact that the senator brought that into the conversation last night was, I would say, a mark of success for the communities of color that have been fighting these issues. I just thought it was too bad that actually the broader issues of environmental degradation and climate change didn't get more attention than they deserved in Houston. Of course, the center of the fossil fuel-based economy, a place where, as you noted in the lead to this show, you know, protesters were blocking oil tankers into the port. So I thought that was a great moment, but one wherein we could have had more conversation about these very important issues in a place where they really need to happen.
Well, last night's debate, as we mentioned, was held at Texas Southern University in Houston. Let's go to California Senator Kamala Harris.
I also want to talk about where we are here at TSU and what it means in terms of HBCUs. I have, as part of my proposal, that we will put $2 trillion into investing in our HBCUs for teachers because one, as a proud graduate of a historically black college and university, I will say that it is our HBCUs that disproportionately produce teachers and those who serve in these many professions. But
thank
also,
you, Senator.
But this is a critical point. If a black child has a black teacher before the end of third grade, they are 13% more likely to go to college. Mm-hmm. If that child has had two black teachers, Before the end of third grade, there are 32% more likely to go to college. So when we talk about investing in our public education system, it is at the source of so much. When we fix it, that will fix so many other things.
That was Senator Kamala Harris. Of course, she was referring. She was a graduate of Howard of Howard University. I wanted to ask again, Rashad Robinson, your response to her remarks.
I mean, I think that once again, this is a recognition of the type of culture change that we are having in this country, where these candidates recognize that they have to come with deep narratives about how they're going to deal with race, but actually clear and specific policies. And that is incredibly important. And her, you know, her recognition of the role that public education has played in the advancement of Black folks and the closing of racial gaps in this country is incredibly important. And also, I think that we just need to hear more from all these candidates, specifically on education. Since 1980 in this country, the geographic segregation in our country, the way that public education has dealt with, we are in positions where we are going back to before Brown versus the Board of Education. And that type of segregation in our schools has directly aligned with the type of funding. And so I am glad that we are talking about what type of investments are going to be made in schools that serve students of color, Black students, Latino students, immigrants. I think it's incredibly important. And once again, this is not just a question of the what, but this is a question of the how. Because the reason why schools have been privatized in cities around this country, the reason why we have underinvestment in our schools, is because corporate profiteers have been able to move the resources that are public into private hands of hedge fund managers and so many others, using a tax on teachers, using a tax on parents and communities as a vehicle to do this. So absolutely, we need investment. I believe in these proposals, but how are we going to deal with all of the incentive structures that have been put in place that are making money off the current system that have to be broken in order for us to achieve the type of success and goals that these policies claim that they're going to give us?
During the debate, Univision anchor Jorge Ramos asked former Vice President Joe Biden about the Obama administration's record on immigration.
Vice President Biden, as a presidential candidate in 2008, you supported the border wall, saying, unlike most Democrats, I voted for 700 miles of fence. This is what you said. Then you served as vice president in an administration that deported 3 million people, the most ever in U.S. history. Did you do anything to prevent those deportations? I mean, you've been asked this question before and refused to answer, so let me try once again. Are you prepared to say tonight that you and President Obama made a mistake about deportations? Why should Latinos trust you?
What Latinos should look at is comparing this president to the president we have is outrageous, number one. We didn't lock people up in cages. We didn't separate families. We didn't do all of those things, number one. Number two, by the time, this is the president who came along with the DACA program. No one had ever done that before. This is the president who sent a legislation to the desk saying he wants to find a pathway for the 11 million undocumented in the United States of America. This is the president who's done a great deal. So I'm proud to have served with him. What I would do as president is several more things, because things have changed. I would, in fact, make sure that we immediately surge to the border. All those people are seeking asylum. They deserve to be heard. That's who we are. We're a nation that says if you want to flee and you're fleeing oppression, you should come. I would change the order that the president just changed, saying women who were being beaten and abused could no longer claim that as a reason for asylum. And by the way, retrospectively, you know, the 25th anniversary of the Violence Against Women Act is up. The Republican Congress has not reauthorized it. Let's put pressure on them to pass the Violence Against Women Act now. But then
yeah,
go
but
back.
You didn't answer the question.
Well,
the question
I did
you make
the question.
Did you make a mistake with those deportations?
The president did the best thing that was able to be done at the
time. How about you?
I'm the vice president of the United States.
Later in the debate, Julian Castro criticized Biden's response.
But my problem with Vice President Biden, and Corey pointed this out last time, is every time something good about Barack Obama comes up, he says, oh, I was there. That's me too. And then every time somebody questions part of the administration that we were both part of, he says, well, that was the president. I mean, he wants to take credit for Obama's work, but not have to answer to any questions.
So that's Julian Castro. Cesar Espinosa, you were at the debate last night. We're talking to you in Houston. Can you talk about their response?
Well, we were very disheartened by Joe Biden's response because he did not take responsibility for what he did and what he and Obama did under the Obama presidency. It is important to point out that up until this point, even though Trump is well on his way to surpass the number of deportations, up until this point, Obama is still the sitting president has deported the most people in U.S. history. So it is important that we hold Biden accountable because he did have a say when he was vice president under President Obama. So we want to applaud Julian for calling that out, for making sure that we hold all elected officials accountable. And later on in the debate, he said that we must hold people accountable for their actions. And that's what we want to do. There's been groups that have been calling out Biden for his record on deportations and for the fact that he cannot deny that there were 3 million people, 3 million families that were broken up under the Obama-Biden presidency. So our fear is that if he does win the nomination, if he does make it into the White House, that it would be more and more of the same thing, more enforcement. And obviously, a lot of our folks in our community find it really disturbing that he actually supported the border wall or building of a border wall when he has criticized Trump for doing the same thing. So we want to see more transparency. We want to see more accountability. And we hope that different groups all over the country continue to raise this issue, and specifically with President Biden, since he is the front runner at this moment.
During the debate, some immigration activists disrupted the discussion. They chanted, "We are DACA recipients. Our lives are at risk." Unfortunately, they couldn't be heard by the TV audience, and it also came later on in the debate.
It's the most significant professional setback you've had to face. How did you recover from it, and what did you learn from it, Vice President Biden?
I never counted any professional setback I have as a serious setback. There's things that are important, things that are unimportant.
Protesters now. Just 1 minute.
Yeah, those were the immigrant rights protesters. Cesar, you were there. What did you see, and what was the reaction of the crowd?
And what were they saying?
Well, it was a coordinated effort by I'm an unknown group to me, folks who were. Who just all of a sudden got up and started chanting. At first, it was very difficult to hear, but when they started taking them off the stage, because they made it all the way up to the stage, we saw their shirts that they talked about DACA, and they were, in fact, chanting that to protect DACA, because if they were to be deported, their lives would be at risk. And they did it at the moment when Vice President Biden started speaking, because once again, we want to make sure that we hold Vice President Biden accountable for the fact that he is deported. And even though the DACA program did come under President Obama, the fact that 3 million people, 3 million families were separated does not outweigh the cost of providing 700,000 undocumented youth a work permit under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. So they were escorted out at one point. We have petitioned the police chief. We don't know the status of these young folks yet, but we have petitioned the chief of police, Art Acevedo, to not press charges, because even that could put their status at risk. They could lose DACA status if they were to be arrested. So we hope that these folks were freed and let go. And once again, they just wanted to get a point across that did no harm to anybody. And all they wanted was to hold Vice President Biden accountable for the fact that he deported 3 million people when he was vice president under President Obama.
Cesar Espinosa is executive director of FIEL, a Houston-based nonprofit that helps undocumented members of Houston's Latino community. Houston, where the debate was held, Rashad Robinson is president of Color of Change, and we're joined by Julian Brave Noisecat, journalist who's director of the Green New Deal strategy at the think tank Data for Progress. We'll continue with them and with highlights of the debate in a minute. Deceptive World by Lydia Mendoza. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, as we continue to cover the Democratic debate in Houston, I'd like to turn to a moment when the Univision anchor Jorge Ramos was questioning Senator Bernie Sanders. But I want to first preface this by saying a lot of people know Univision, and they know that Univision has always been reporting extensively on the plight of immigrants in the United States. But a lot of folks who don't know Spanish and follow Univision, who don't follow Univision regularly, don't know that also Univision's role in terms of reporting on Latin America has always been to bash socialist or progressive or populist governments in Latin America. So it's no surprise to those of us who regularly watch Univision that Jorge Ramos would ask Bernie Sanders this question about Venezuela and democratic socialism.
Senator Sanders, one country where many immigrants are arriving from is Venezuela. A recent UN fact-finding mission found that thousands have been disappeared, tortured, and killed by government forces in Venezuela. You admit that Venezuela does not have free elections, but still you refuse to call Nicolás Maduro un dictador, a dictator. Can you explain why, and what are the main differences between your kind of socialism and the one being imposed in Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua?
Well, first of all, let me be very clear. Anybody who does what Maduro does is a vicious tyrant. What we need now is international and regional cooperation for free elections in Venezuela so that the people of that country can make and can create their own future. In terms of democratic socialism, to equate what goes on in Venezuela with what I believe is extremely unfair. I'll tell you what I believe in terms of democratic socialism. I agree with what goes on in Canada and in Scandinavia, guaranteeing health care to all people as a human right. I believe that the United States should not be the only major country on earth not to provide paid family and medical leave. I believe that every worker in this country deserves a living wage and that we expand the trade union movement. I happen to believe also that what, to me, democratic socialism means is we deal with an issue we do not discuss enough, Jorge, not in the media and not in Congress. You got three people in America owning more wealth than the bottom half of this country. You got a handful of billionaires controlling what goes on in Wall Street, the insurance companies, and in the media. Maybe, just me, maybe, what we should be doing is creating an economy that works for all of us, not 1%. That's my understanding of democratic socialism.
Secretary Augusta, do you want it?
And Julian Brave Noisecat, I wanted to ask you this whole issue of now a couple of debates now, the issue of democratic socialism being raised by the moderators to try to pin one or the other candidates on that issue.
So, you know, I answer this question as, you know, I have bylines in both Jacobin and Dissent and subscribe to both of those magazines, which would be identified as left or socialist. You know, I have many friends who have gotten engaged in the Democratic Socialists of America. And generally speaking, I would say that there is, particularly among millennials, increasing interest in socialism, particularly because, you know, we lived through, you know, one of our formative experiences was first the recession and crisis of 2008, and then, of course, the campaign of Senator Sanders in 2016. So I think that, you know, socialism is a rising political force in this country. But it is true that, you know, which kind of socialism we are fighting for, what our vision for a socialist movement might be, is a relevant sort of issue, right? Because there are, you know, troubling legacies of socialist regimes around the country. And I think that, you know, I was in Washington, D.C. actually back in May when Senator Sanders gave his speech on democratic socialism and made clear what he means when he embraces that term, and that he's talking about the legacies of people like FDR. You know, he's talking about the legacies of people who fight for universal human rights, the right to health care, the right to housing, economic and social rights. And I think that, you know, continuing to distinguish that this is exactly what the broader left generally and then what the socialist movement in particular is pushing for is an important thing. And, you know, I think it's great that that kind of a message is getting shared on cable news. So, you know, the question might have been unfair, but I thought that the senator handled it well.
And very quickly, Julian Brave Noisecat, on the issue of ANWR, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, a whole group of members of the Gwich'in Steering Committee traveled to Washington to lobby for the drilling ban as the House of Representatives voted to block President Trump from opening up ANWR to oil and gas exploration. The significance of this?
You know, so last night, one of the big underlying questions is what the broader Democratic coalition is going to look like. And one thing that was very disappointing to me is that not a single candidate, not a diverse candidate, not one of the older candidates, not when we talked about immigration, brought up the reality of Native people in this country. And one of the big issues that we face is the degradation of our homelands and the attack by the fossil fuel industry, by the Republican Party on the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge is one of those major issues. And, you know, I would be very hopeful that candidates would try to speak to those issues in the future and on the debate stage moving forward.
Let's go back to last night's debate. This is Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren.
So our trade policy in America has been broken for decades, and it has been broken because it works for giant multinational corporations and not for much of anyone else. These are giant corporations that, shoot, if they can save a nickel by moving a job to a foreign country, they'll do it in a heartbeat. And yet, for decades now, who's been whispering in the ears of our trade negotiators? Who has shaped our trade policy? It's been the giant corporations. It's been their lobbyists and their executives. The way we change our trade policy in America is first, the procedures. Who sits at the table? I want to negotiate trade with unions at the table. I want to negotiate it with small farmers at the table. I want to negotiate it with environmentalists at the table. I want to negotiate with human rights activists at the table.
And that was Elizabeth Warren on trade. And here's Elizabeth Warren talking about Afghanistan.
What we're doing right now in Afghanistan is not helping the safety and security of the United States. It is not helping the safety and security of the world. It is not helping the safety and security of Afghanistan. We need to bring our troops home.
Rashad Robinson, you're reacting to some of these moments in Elizabeth Warren at the debate last night.
I mean, I think it's deeply powerful that we have, you know, candidates on the stage willing to talk about corporate power, you know, on corporate media. I mean, a lot of why we had certain questions, if you look at the, you know, the conversation earlier about the Jorge Ramos questions, right, those are deeply also rooted in the fact of who gets to control the platforms that these debates are had on. We are already playing on a field. We're already talking on a platform that is controlled by a set of elites that don't want the type of radical change that's going to lift all boats. And so the fact that Elizabeth Warren is willing to go on these platforms, willing to talk about corporate power, willing to talk about, you know, how she will want these folks at the table. But it's not simply about being at the table. It's about fundamentally changing the table. And changing the table once again requires these candidates to articulate and be connected to how they're going to work with, engage, and empower movements to do so. Part of why a school, you know, of white children can get shot up and no meaningful reform on guns happens, even though the vast majority of Americans want it, is because the movements on the right have made it possible for politicians to believe that they can't make those type of changes, even if they believe it's possible. And so what are we going to build on the left that is powerful enough, and how are our candidates going to be accountable to those movements and connected to those movements? Because only then do we turn the vision of the ideas, the vision of the polls, the vision of what we believe as possible into the actual reality. People drive the type of change that's possible, not politicians.
We're going to turn right now to our last clip, which was actually the beginning of the whole debate last night, and it was around the issue of Medicare for All. This is Senator Amy Klobuchar.
And while Bernie wrote the bill, I read the bill. And on page eight of the bill, it says that we will no longer have private insurance as we know it. And that means that 149 million Americans will no longer be able to have their current insurance. That's in 4 years. I don't think that's a bold idea. I think it's a bad idea.
Page 8 of the bill, she says, 149 people will lose their health insurance. Right.
What this is about is making sure that we have the most efficient way possible to pay for health care for everyone in this country. Insurance companies last year sucked $23 billion in profits out of the system. How did they make that money? Every one of those $23 billion was made by an insurance company saying no to your health care company.
Mayor Buttigieg.
The problem, Senator Sanders, with that damn bill that you wrote and that Senator Warren backs is that it doesn't trust the American people. I trust you to choose what makes the most sense for you, not my way or the highway. Now, look, I think we do have to go far beyond tinkering with the ACA. I propose Medicare for all who want it.
Senator Sanders, 45 seconds.
George, you talked about, was it 150 million people on private insurance? 50 million of those people lose their private insurance every year when they quit their jobs or they go unemployed or their employer changes their insurance policy. Medicare for All is comprehensive health care, covers all basic needs, including home health care. It allows you to go to any doctor you want, which many private insurance company programs do not. So if you want comprehensive health care, freedom of choice regarding doctor or hospital, no more than $200 a year for prescription drugs, taking on the drug companies and the insurance companies, moving to Medicare for All is the way to go.
Just some of the candidates speaking last night in Houston at the historically black college, Texas Southern University, in their third major Democratic debate. That last person, of course, was Senator Bernie Sanders. Before that, Indiana South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar. I want to thank our guests for being with us, Cesar Espinosa, Executive Director of FIEL, a Houston-based nonprofit that helps undocumented members of the Latino community in Houston, Julian Brave Noisecat, director of the Green New Deal Strategy at the think tank Data for Progress, and Rashad Robinson, president of Color of Change. And that does it for our show. Today, we will be covering Greta Thunberg with many others outside the White House for this Friday for Future, the protest around climate change that's been taking place around the globe. To go to our hour on Greta Thunberg, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.